Welcome to the Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel. I am not joined, as always, today by Bruce Feldman, who has double duty sideline reporting this week. He couldn't join me, so I was like, who could I get to be a fill-in co-host? And you know what happened? My friend Nicole Auerbach at USA Today, I saw her pictures from Seattle, that she was in Seattle this week, one of my favorite cities, and home of the Washington Huskies, who are hosting USC this weekend. I thought it would be very timely to bring Nicole on and talk about Washington, but also many other topics. And to be clear, the election will not be one of them, Nicole.
That's probably a good idea.
This now seems like a million years ago because of last night, but there were some new playoff rankings Tuesday night. Washington does move up to number four. Now, I assume when you did the interviews that, you know, they're in their complex at that point, they didn't know yet.
What's the vibe
there in terms of feeling whether they were being taken seriously enough by the committee?
Well, it was interesting. And by the way, they're super weird to, like, process when it's still daylight. I'm so used to watching the ranking show on the East Coast that it was, like, a very strange experience.
4 o'clock here.
Yeah, I, like, wasn't ready for it. But it was funny because you do the defensive player availability on Tuesdays. So earlier in the day, a couple of the beat writers were there and they're like, so how do you think it's going to go tonight? And I assumed that they were talking about the election, of course. And they're like, yeah, you know, I think they're going to be number five behind Ohio State. And I was like, oh, right. The rankings are coming. So, you know, I think that they were pretty prepared to have the same consistent criteria applied against them and to have Ohio State be number four. I've not been around Chris Peterson probably as much as you have, but I would expect that rankings mean literally nothing to him. He was asked about it a few times this week, and he's like, you know, we can only control how we approach our next game, which is what any coach would say. But I think some other coaches are, I don't think they're watching the show, but I think they're more aware and wanting to know where they stand or what, you know, what their upcoming opponents are ranked and types of things like that. I don't think that matters that much to Washington. I think that I had predicted going to last weekend by not being in the top four as an undefeated power conference team that they would play with a little bit of the proverbial chip on the shoulder and play very well against Cal, which they did. So, you know, I don't think that it's a bad thing to be five. I don't think it means that much different to be four. I think it was a little confusing for us. I know we had talked before the show, and your prediction was that Ohio State would be number four based on consistency. So it's just, you know, it's only week two of the midseason rankings, and we're already at the point where they're trying to justify changes that are not consistent with the way that they described the previous week.
You're right. I did predict Ohio State would be number four. I guess the theme of Tuesday all around was missed projections.
Yours didn't matter that much, though.
In the end of the day, no, they do not. You know, I do think it is interesting. I wonder how much the players do. I'm sure they watch the show if they're able to, and I'm sure care.
Here's a weird aside. I was actually with the basketball team, like, right as the show was airing, and they were all like, oh, we're four. Like, they care. Yeah.
Let's be honest. The players care. In fact, last year, the Notre Dame Showtime series, you know, they were going through it. And I vividly remember a scene where they were watching the show. Because you remember, Notre Dame at first looked like they were in great shape. And then there was one week where they just kind of, as the committee does, they just, like, mysteriously dropped from fourth to sixth. And that was captured on Showtime. And they were just devastated. You know, you would think it was the actual playoff announcement. So I do think the players care. But, of course, it's up to the coach to get them to, you know, not focus on that. And I do wonder if it affected Texas A&M last week. You know, I mean, does finding out that, hey, that Alabama loss basically didn't count, you're already back in the top four, does that make you be maybe a little complacent when you play Mississippi State?
Well, yeah, and they had injuries, and that's a separate thing. But, you know, I actually wondered about Penn State with that. Like, they were so surprisingly high at 12. I was like, well, are they going to be able to handle the fact that, like Texas A&M, people are going to say really nice things about them? Like, they're going to be in, like, a really good spot and, like, well-respected by people who really know football, blah, blah, blah. And they were the opposite. They came out and played really, really well against Iowa. So, like, I do think that it's a very interesting, like, mid-season psychological piece that gets added to the season now, which is, like, something that is, like, a side effect of what we originally thought when we thought the playoff was coming.
Yeah, and, of course, Bobby Petrino talked about, you know, his reaction to it was clearly, well, I better start running up the score. I understand why he feels that way, but that's not why they were a little bit lower in the rankings.
Right.
And I don't think, you know, once you win by whatever would be considered a comfortable margin, I don't really think the committee cares what you pile on top of that. But yeah, let's talk for a second about what I thought was a very disappointing explanation from Kirby Hocutt about why Washington was ahead. And just to be clear, I think Washington should be the number four team in the country.
Yes,
they're a 9-0. Yeah, I mean, they're not like Florida State a couple years ago where they were escaping almost every single week. They've, for the most part, been dominant. So you think they should be four?
Mm-hmm. There's only four undefeated Power 5 teams. And they're not in the Big 12, which we think is – that's a league that really did poorly in the non-conference and – for, you know, like, it's not that conference, which to me is clearly the fifth of the five. So I don't see, I understand that, you know, backloading of schedule and Stanford and Oregon not being strong this year and things like that. But there's a ton of respect for Michigan, and Michigan's toughest games are at the end of the year too.
Well, you know, we're still relatively new in this system, and I know myself and Heather Dinich at ESPN and others who cover this very closely, we parse every word because we're still learning their process. And yes, I have a little sympathy, obviously, for Kirby. He's summing up the thoughts of 12 people. And, you know, this was a 2-day process and he's explaining it in a few minutes. But I just thought it was really disappointing that if you're going to come out the week before and say that you felt a one loss A&M team should be ahead of undefeated Washington because they had more wins against plus 500 teams, then the next week comes up and they seemingly, the decision this week would favor Ohio State even more so under that rationale. They, after beating Nebraska like they did, have three top 20 wins. Washington has one.
Well, and Penn State is now a top 10 team.
Which, you know, makes it all the more bizarre that his justification was, well, the committee felt that the reason that Washington's ahead in this case, as opposed to last week, is last week the one-loss team's loss was to number one Alabama, and this week the one loss team's loss was to Penn State. Yes, Alabama, I think we would agree, much tougher opponent to play. It's the first time I can remember in 3 years that they used a loss or who you lost to as a justification for anything. It's always been who you beat.
Yeah. No, that is interesting because I remember, especially year one, when we didn't quite know what was going to matter most. Especially before the conference championships, which we didn't realize, you know, how heavily those would be taken into consideration. I did evaluate by loss. You know, I was like, that's a better loss. That's a closer loss. That's a loss on the road to a better team. And that wasn't what I was hearing out of the committee. So it's interesting because obviously this year's committee makeup is different. You have people had rolled off the committee. People have come in. You've got a new chairman. So it's a different conversation and vibe, and again, all the things that we get mid-season are we all have to take with a grain of salt because it's incomplete resumes. And like you said, I mean, you're trying to not give away much, but also trying to explain what 12 different people think about something over a 2-day conversation that week. And theoretically, they're starting from scratch each week, yet they're being evaluated on, well, like, why was Texas A&M ahead of Washington last week, and now Washington is ahead of Ohio State? Where if you really started from scratch, you're not thinking that way. But it was interesting because I do think the losses should matter. But in this sense, a loss on the road to a top 10 team in a close game is, to me, very similar to a blowout loss to Alabama. I mean, they people were like, oh, it was a good loss to Alabama, but it wasn't close. Like, and that was part of the thing that surprised me. I think right now also, especially with week two, Texas A&M staying in the top 10, you know, I just think that there's a lot of, you still have a lot of those people who believe that the SEC gets a certain level of respect that, you know, maybe they don't deserve every single year, that still exists just by virtue of how it's gone 2 weeks in.
If they were tracking it by losses, then there would be no way to explain why Texas A&M, who lost by 19 to Alabama, is on the road, is eighth, and LSU, who lost 10-0 in a game that was nothing-nothing in the fourth quarter, dropped 11 spots on Tuesday.
That made no sense. None. And Nebraska's blowout loss to Ohio State, they didn't drop that far. Like, it made zero sense. And this is the rankings where we're supposed to be taking into consideration, like, how the teams look, how they win, how they lose, where they're doing it. This is not the coaches' poll or the AP poll where people are just looking at results and sliding people up and down. Like, this is the one where it's not supposed to matter, like, how many losses you have or this or that. And you see, like, I mean, USC got ranked in this ranking and they're not in the polls, which is good because they do look like a top 20 team. But it was just, I don't understand the LSU piece at all. If you watch that game, that was a team that played Alabama better than anybody else so far this year.
Yeah, you brought up something I've been talking about too, and I don't know if how much people realize this about the changeover in the committee of the 13 people who were on the original committee, and one of those, Archie Manning, never actually ended up serving. Only seven remain, so almost half of this committee has changed over in 2 years, and yet, you know, it may be that some of the new people value things differently than some of the old people. You know, Tom Osborne is no longer on it. And I would assume Tom Osborne is somebody who's probably going to go more on what he has seen with his own eyes versus numbers. And I do think this committee is tracking numbers very closely, strength of schedule numbers in particular, because if you're like me, baffled why A&M would be number eight, both because did you just watch them? Did you watch them against Mississippi State? They couldn't make a tackle. In fact, by the way, aren't they supposed to be taking injuries into consideration? They now know Trevor Knight is out.
For the year.
At least the regular season. Although I suppose they could also say, well, we're giving them a little credit in that game because they lost him. So.
Well, clearly with that situation is they're just going head-to-head. That they beat Auburn, so they're not willing to drop them below Auburn right now.
Well, I disagree with that, too. I have a lot of problems that A&M's ranking. Okay, so if it's a situation like 2 years ago with Baylor and TCU where they literally played, you know, 10 of the 12 games were basically the same, they played all of the same conference opponents, they had the same record, then yes, head-to-head should be the tiebreaker. But I don't feel at this point in the season that A&M and Auburn are that close, that a game from 2 months ago when Auburn had not yet figured out the offense that they're basically using right now and A&M was in better injury shape, that should be a determining factor. You know, I don't think A&M should be there. Now, the one thing I noticed is if you go on ESPN's strength of record metric, which is like strength of schedule, except it literally measures, you know, how hard would it be to go 8-1 against this schedule as opposed to 9-0 against another schedule, Texas A&M is eighth.
Well, I mean, I think when you're laying out what you're going to evaluate these teams on, and head-to-head should be in there, I agree with you, and this is how the committee viewed it a few years ago, because if you remember, the team that beat the other team was below in the rankings.
For most of the year, yeah, or all the way up to the last one.
And I know that there's a different makeup to the committee, but you could say that is only going to be taken into consideration when resumes are complete. When you have the full picture, and like in that situation, you had teams that were competing for the same spot or like the same two or three spots and they were really close. But I don't think, I'm with you, I don't think at this point in the season and at this point in these midseason rankings, you would need to do that at all. Because I think you could take more into consideration what the team looks like now. I mean, if they played last week, that's different. But like you said, 2 months ago, I mean, everyone thought Auburn was going to hire a new coach. Everyone thought, you know, I mean, everyone thought Texas A&M was legit. And I mean, they thought that for a few more weeks. But those teams are very different now. And like you said, the injury to Trevor Knight is a huge thing moving forward. So I understand why you'd want to be consistent with some of your metrics and some of the things that were the rules and things that you're taking into consideration to make these rankings. But I think that's when you could literally say, hey, this is important, but it's only going to be important when we know everything else and those teams are actually in competition for the same spots.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Baylor TCU year. Every single week, people would get on them about the head Baylor being behind TCU, and every single week, Jeff Long would say, "Well, we don't think their resumes are close enough yet to use that as a tiebreaker." And then at the end of the season, they did.
Yeah, it should be a tiebreaker, and we don't need that yet.
To be clear, somebody could argue that Texas A&M does have a better resume. Their win over Auburn, I don't think Auburn has a win like that. I'm more talking about, and this is where a committee is supposed to come into play and use their own eyes and common sense. Okay, these two teams are not the same today that they were on September 19th, and they are doing that with other teams. They've clearly done that with Penn State. They're clearly doing that by putting a three-loss USC in there.
Right, and I like that. I mean, that is something. The fact that Colorado is higher in the rankings and the playoff rankings and Penn State is too, that is to me the best part about these. And you know, I'm not a huge fan of midseason rankings. I mean, I know why they're there.
I know. This must pain you to have to even have this conversation.
I know. I'm taking it very seriously, Stu, because I know you do. But there's so many, like the conference championship is such a big piece to this. And so to be projecting and thinking about things without that element, it's not a great use of our time, I'll go there. I'll have this conversation, but I like that Penn State and Colorado and USC show why these are good. Cause this isn't starting from scratch. You're not starting with a preseason poll or preseason ranking. So you're actually like, those are where those teams should be. And there's no idea of what they should have looked like or what they were in the off season or if a coach was on the hot seat or anything like that. There's taken into consideration that USC had a quarterback change, that Penn State figured out how to have an offense. Like there are different things that get taken into consideration that aren't when you're starting with here's the preseason top 25. And maybe James Franklin is on the hot seat and Colorado's Colorado and, you know, this and that. I mean, that's why I do like the fact that once these rankings start, you can use these numbers because I think they more accurately, in most cases, not Texas A&M, not LSU, I think in most cases, they more accurately represent where these teams are now.
So let's just spin ahead now. I do think Kirby Hokut brought up something last night that I found I hadn't thought of. I knew it was. I knew there were more two-loss teams at this point than there were last year. I didn't realize quite how dramatic it was. He pointed out that last year, at this time, there was only one 7-2 team in the top 15. This year, same week, nine 7-2 teams in the top 15.
Good. I like that.
What do you mean?
Well, it's going back to my point that like just because you lose a game, you don't automatically drop 15 spots.
Well, but it's not necessarily because of their rationale. It's because there just aren't any. West Virginia is the only other one-loss Power 5 team that's kind of buried down there at number 16. Other than that, that's just where we are at this point. And so do we think everybody's waiting for chaos? This has just been too orderly so far this season. You're literally looking at four undefeated Power 5 teams here, and three of those, Alabama, Clemson, and Michigan, have really separated themselves with their resumes. You know, they each have three. I think Alabama has four now top 25 wins over the committee's top 25. Now that Arkansas is in there, and Clemson and Michigan have three. So, you know, on the one hand, you see these two lost teams creeping awfully close. Wisconsin's number seven. On the other hand, people are looking at those teams saying, "Well, when are they going to lose? If they're going to lose?" At this point, if you had to guess, do you think your top four is going to be fairly orderly? And it's going to be those four teams, or it's going to maybe be Ohio State subbing in for Michigan, or, you know, is this going to actually end up being controversial?
Well, I don't know if you would agree with this, but I sort of think the whole season has been fairly boring, especially if Lamar Jackson wins the Heisman, like wire to wire Heisman.
Not a lot of suspense so far this season.
Which is interesting because, like, remember the first year at the playoff, obviously Ohio State getting in, and then that run and Cardale Jones, there was like so much excitement and intrigue. And then last year, there was not much. I didn't have any questions like waking up on the final ranking day. I mean, you knew who was going to be in. There wasn't going to be controversy. I mean, the playoff itself turned out to be interesting, but again, blowouts. And then we did have an interesting championship game. I've had this conversation with a lot of people this year because, like you said, you have four unbeaten Power 5 conference teams. And history would say that, you know, we're not going to have multiple unbeaten teams in the playoffs.
There have never been four undefeated Power 5 teams, and there will not be this season.
Have there been three?
In the BCS, there were three in 2004, USC, Oklahoma, Auburn. And then in 2009, if you count Cincinnati, who was in the Big East, which was a BCS conference, there were three that year. That's it. That's the most there's ever been. I'm going to end up looking like the political polls if there does end up being four undefeated, because I have actually guaranteed that there won't be.
No, I don't think there would be. But at this point, like, obviously it's very hard to see Alabama losing. It's hard to see Clemson losing. You know, I do think the Big Ten is interesting, but I think also it's fairly boring. Even if you like are like, okay, well, Ohio State could sub in for Michigan. Right now it seems like there are five playoff teams. I think Louisville would need a whole lot of help to get into this picture by being a non-conference champion and not having the kind of resume and strength of schedule that these other teams have, particularly with the Big Ten getting so much respect and so many ranked teams. That just guarantees that, you know, a one loss and potentially two loss Big Ten teams are going to be getting consideration ahead of Louisville. But the only thing that it does with, like, a two-loss Wisconsin at seven, which is a very good team, that means that if they win the Big Ten championship game, they'll get in.
Yeah, so I think your best hope for chaos is...
Is upsets in the championship
games. Upsets in the championship games. Virginia Tech over Clemson, which is perfectly, you know, a reasonable scenario that could happen.
Or Auburn beating Alabama at the end of the year. And then...
Not as reasonable a scenario, but yes.
Well, that's chaos.
That would be enormous chaos, and I should not downplay Auburn. They've pulled that off before. And also, you know, and this will segue into what, you know, we want to talk about Washington. You're there. They could lose the Apple Cup. They could be 11-0, lose the Apple Cup to Washington State and not even win its division, depending on how Washington State does before then. So, you know, those are probably your three most – if you say which games would most likely have results – that would shake this whole thing up, I would say the ACC title game, the Big Ten title game, and the Apple Cup.
Well, and I also will say that it's a good thing that FCS opponents are not taking into consideration Pac-12 standings for Washington State.
Speaking of that, the committee is like, you can't tell me there are 22 teams right now that you would pick to beat Washington State if they were playing. This is a team that they're not giving credit for how much better they are than they were at the beginning of the season, but I guess the stigma of losing to FCS is just too hard for them to overcome.
Well, I think it's definitely it literally is a different level than losing to a MAC team or like someone that you shouldn't. So I'm fine with that. But you're right. There are a few situations here where we can have some chaos. I have been all season long kind of angling for, I want, like, if Michigan, all right, let's see, the best scenario for this would be Ohio State beating Michigan and then Ohio State winning the championship game. And then what do you do with a one-loss Michigan when their best loss is, or their only loss is to a playoff team? So I want to be in a situation, maybe not this year, but, like, you know, I root for chaos in general. So I want to be in a situation where you legitimately have two teams from one league that have a shot. And I think it's going to have to be a team in the same division as the team that wins and goes, and that their only loss is to that team. And I think that, like, there would be that scenario. It certainly depends on, like, how Washington's season goes and Clemson's and what we talked about conference championship games. But I kind of just want to have that question lingering over the final weekend.
Yeah, I think a fascinating one would be 12-1 Pac-12 champ Washington against 11-1 Michigan or 11-1 Louisville.
I would love to see how that goes.
So... Washington. Here's my first question about your trip there. Does the Starbucks taste better in Seattle than it does everywhere else?
I don't go to Starbucks every single day like you do. But I do think it does, and I've had a lot of Starbucks. I went to the original Starbucks, and I went like on an afternoon, Monday late afternoon. It was like pretty empty. I also bought a mug because, like, of course I have to say that I went to the original Starbucks. And it was great. I got to see, like, Pike Place Market. I've never been to Seattle, by the way. Just throw that out there. Like, this is
one of my absolute favorite cities in America.
It is phenomenal. And by the way, it hasn't rained, like, at all. And it's been, like, beautiful. And I've just, like, I talked to Lorenzo Romar yesterday. And I walked into his office and I was like, you know, everyone told me it always rained here. And he's like, shh, don't tell people that it doesn't. And I was like, I get it. I get it now.
You should mention, by the way, that you've been on, like, a travel run lately that anybody would be jealous of.
Yeah, I've had a good fall.
Yeah, you were in, just by coincidence, you were in Chicago the day of the Cubs parade.
Yes.
And it was, you know, Chicago in November, and what was it, 65 degrees or something?
Yeah, I think it hit 70, to be honest.
Now you're in Seattle, and it's not raining. And then tell us about your most proud accomplishment from that trip to, we should say, to Evanston.
Okay, well, you're going to need to get on Twitter or Instagram for this, because the visual is the important part. But I love Veep. Like, it is my number one favorite show.
Funniest show on television.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus would be the only person. Like, I mean, you know, Stu, we, like, cover famous athletes and, like, interact with them. Like, I don't fangirl ever because, like, I see people doing that. And I think it's, like, I feel bad for the people who, like, you know, are constantly getting asked for autographs and photos and people fawning all over them. So I don't do that. And I don't even do, like, I've had some good celebrity sightings in New York, and I just, like, kind of ignore them and then text my friends about it afterwards. But Julia Louis-Dreyfus, if I ever ran into her, I would completely fangirl and need to take a photo and, like, just tell her how amazing she is. But I came, apparently, really, really close to meeting her. I was at the Northwestern-Wisconsin game with Jim Delaney on Saturday, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus posts a selfie with her son, who's on the Northwestern basketball team, and I believe her husband, he looks familiar. And I am in the background. It's me and Jim Delaney and Jason Yellen, who works in the Big Ten office, literally in the background. I am like a centimeter away from her head in this photo.
You're photobombing Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Photobombing Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
But that also begs the question of, you know, you just kind of casually said, yeah, I'm sitting there with Jim Delaney. Like, you and Jim, you know, are you up there? You guys are tight. You're plotting next year's Friday night schedule together. You're responsible for Northwestern playing two Friday night games.
Well, clearly, because we were at Northwestern.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, and I'm the one who has to, you know, I'm the Michigan alum. I need to bridge the gap and get Michigan on board. No, you know, I was spending the day with him for a couple different things, and part of the day was to go to this game. And we actually spent about almost a quarter of the game in Barry Alvarez's box, which, by the way, is highly entertaining. He gets really into the plays and the footballs and missed tackles and big passes. So it was a really fun day, but the highlight by a mile is that I accidentally photobombed Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
And by the way, we should mention the reason you might be wondering right now, why is Julia Louis-Dreyfus at a Northwestern-Wisconsin game? Her son is a walk-on member of the Northwestern basketball team.
Yes, and believe me, I've already pitched doing a story about, you know, watching a game with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
And how's that going?
We'll see. You know, maybe, I don't know. I mean, maybe Veep, you know, because of the election and how crazy it was, maybe there is no future seasons for Veep. And she will have...
How can we top what actually happened?
Right. So maybe she will have lots of free time moving forward.
Okay. So I do want to get into Big Ten Friday night games, because it's been a hot story this week, but we keep getting away from Washington. Poor Washington. We're exerting East Coast bias right here from the West Coast. You know, I haven't been around this team yet. And, you know, what's happening... what Chris Peterson is doing is kind of what I thought he would, frankly. He was such a good coach at Boise State. Give him a little bit of time, he would turn that program around, which has always been a sleeping giant, in my opinion. You're too young to remember this, but there was a time when Washington was one of the premier programs in the country. And so when people think of his Boise State teams, right, it was... the unheralded, the Kellen Moores, the, you know, you name them, nobody wanted these guys. They were completely overlooked. And he turns them into a team that beats Georgia and Virginia Tech and whatnot. Now he's in a Power Five conference, and these are players who were big name. Buda Baker, you know, these guys were big name recruits. Jake Browning was obviously a big name recruit. I don't know if you have a good comparison to Boise, but how would you describe the culture of this Washington team?
Well, I mean, I never went, like, I didn't visit the Boise teams when Chris Peterson was there, but I can't imagine it was that different. Like, I'm doing a story about John Ross and what a phenomenal receiver he's turned into. Obviously, he had a huge game against Cal, but he's a great story. I mean, he had two knee surgeries last year, he had to play some defense as a sophomore. and, you know, comes in and watches film of himself and is critiquing himself. And we talk about Jake Browning and why he's been able to have the season he's had. But it's interesting because all the coaches sound like Chris Peterson. Obviously, he has a few that came over from Boise and that culture there. But the coaches and the players kind of just describe it as this positive reinforcement kind of coaching style. And it's just, it sounds like they all genuinely just enjoy being there every day. I mean, like, these guys are genuinely, like, thrilled for Jake Browning and the season he's having. And they're not also, like, caught up in it all. Like I said, I mean, I'm sure they watch the rankings. I'm sure that they, like, care a little bit, but I don't think it actually matters their day-to-day because I think they're just, you know, they've got USC this weekend. You know, they know they're having a good season, but they don't really, like, it doesn't get to their head. I mean, Chris Peterson doesn't do a ton of media, which,
no,
you know,
he does not.
And I think that he, you know, is much more of those coaches that's like, I'm a football coach. But they're so sound on both sides of the ball. They're really fun to watch. And like you said, I mean, they're like, East Coast bias is a thing. I mean, it affected Christian McCaffrey last year. And so I think that, you know, maybe not everyone has seen Washington enough and or has said, you know, Stanford was down, Oregon was down. You know, sure, those numbers are crazy, but, you know, what do we really know? But I mean, I think they're a very, very good team. They did lose Joe Mathis, who was the sack leader on the team. But they still have really good defensive linemen. They're not that worried about it. I mean, they're bummed for Joe, but they, you know, it's a next guy up thing. I mean, a lot of what they say sounds cliche, but they all really seem to buy into that mentality and not getting too high or too low on any of that.
Jake Browning, not the whole offense. You know, he's been the star player. He's not the whole offense. But if you watch the Cal game the other night, the guy that was standout to anybody is John Ross. Stud playmaker. I understood you spent some time with him.
Yeah, and I mean, he had that highlight reel touchdown where he juked out, like, the entire secondary of Cal and like, on the 20-yard line and then ran for a touchdown and had three in the first half. And he's a great story. So, you know, he was at Washington before Peterson got there. And then his sophomore year, he was kind of inconsistent as a receiver, had, you know, it was fine, and then ended up playing some cornerback for Peterson. And then last year had knee injuries and surgeries on both knees, not at the same time, because I don't know how you'd get around if that happened. But he was basically healthy enough, cleared enough by the end of last season. So he was fully healthy for spring. And Bush Hamden is the receivers coach, and he actually was from Boise with Peterson. So this is his first year with the receivers. And he was talking about how John had to learn. Now, he's always been like the fastest. He's the fastest guy on the team, and he's always been one of the fastest guys everywhere he plays. And he always thought, and John told me this, he's like, you know, I always thought, like, well, why wouldn't you just always go really fast? Like, why would you have different speeds? And so that's something that they've worked on with him, and, like, also just technique-wise, you know, and he has just evolved into this complete receiver. And you see that this season. He's having a sensational year. And Jake Browning's been really good with multiple receivers. And part of that is because, like, for example, John Ross is coming off injury. So as soon as he was cleared, he said him and Jake were throwing every single day, anytime they could, anytime. It was Christmas break, whatever, every day, even when it wasn't part of practice. So I think that he and Jake Browning, you know, they just have worked on these, on chemistry and routes and all of these different little things for so long, dating back to the end of last season. And you're seeing it now, and it looks pretty effortless in many ways. But it's like, it's just little tweaks. And like for Ross, it's a lot about, you know, just using your speeds in different ways, lateral movements, footwork, different things like that, that if you're just a fast guy, you don't always think of. But it's just, I always love when guys come back from, you know, ACL or, you know, serious injuries and are able to move like that. I mean, that's just amazing to me as someone who's, knock on wood, never had a serious knee injury, that you would physically be able to do that after something like that, or want to. Like, I would be terrified of cutting if I had a knee injury, you know, and to come back.
Yeah, I don't know how they have, and sometimes you do see that where guys don't have necessarily the comp. I thought Deshaun Watson early last season was a little tentative from his injury the year before.
Yeah. But
somehow they get over it. Another place you've spent some time around this season is your alma mater, Michigan. And in particular, you did you did like a whole series of articles about Jabril Peppers. If he wins the Heisman, you're going to get to put out like your own special commemorative issue about Jabril Peppers. He strikes me as a guy who is really embracing the Heisman candidacy and the kind of star that's being created around him, but without necessarily being cocky about it.
Yeah, he is very down to earth. He is from New Jersey, the greatest state in the country. And he just like, you know, he, one of the, again, yeah, it was like a three-story package. And one was about his dad went to prison when he was about seven, and his older brother was shot and killed when he was about 14, I think, and it, kind of in his formative years. And he just got very focused at that point, and his mom kept him very focused on school and football. And so he kind of has just always been this guy who just works really hard and absorbs everything football-wise. And his mom actually pulled him out of, if he didn't get good grades, she would pull him out of football games. So in high school, he didn't even fail, he claims. And she didn't let him play a game. He managed to go sit on the sidelines and watch the game. And she said, you know, and he was like, you know, after that, like, there was no other problems. Like, you know, moms get their point across. And so, you know, Michigan has obviously that balance of academics and the school and the football, but he is so dynamic, and they've kind of just like expanded the playbook more and more because he was there. I mean, he was a Brady Hoke recruit. And so it's kind of been a slow progression. He also had an injury as well, but he now, you know, is playing all sorts of different positions on defense. He's playing everywhere on special teams and lining up wherever on offense too. And, you know, one thing I thought was really interesting, cause I mean, a lot of people have written about his versatility, and what that might mean for the Heisman race, but you know, he's saying just kind of how easy it is for him to pick up different, you know, responsibilities as a defensive player and like how easy it is as the offense. Like people just kind of, and his coaches are telling me, you know, you just tell him something once and he gets it. Or if he makes a mistake, he makes it once and then he never does it again. And I was like, you know, a lot of players could say that or want to do that, but how do you do it? And he basically said, he's like, I don't have a photographic memory, but I can see something once and I'll remember it. Like, it's not like you could read a book and like just flip through the pages. But I thought that was really interesting because when people talk about football IQ and like understanding the game, usually it's very vague, but he seems to like really get it quickly on a different level.
It's interesting. You mentioned how he was a Brady Hoke recruit, and this doesn't often come to fruition, but you know, he was, I believe, the number one player in the country or close to it. And, you know, amidst the mediocrity of Brady Hoke, you know, he was the great hope for Michigan fans. Well, at least he's on the way, he's coming. And then he got there and things were disastrous that, you know, Brady Hoke's last season, but you know, hey, we've got this great true freshman, and it's come to pass. I mean, here they are smack dab in the national title conversation for the first time in a decade. And he's, you know, the face of the team. Now, to be clear, there are a lot of great players on that team. That's why they are undefeated. But he's definitely kind of, to me at least, when people think Michigan this year, they think of him first, which is actually pretty rare, given the position he is listed at. Of course, as we know, and they throw the graphics up during the game, he plays about 9 different positions if you count return man. So, you know, the Heisman race, we've talked about a million times. It does seem like it's Lamar Jackson's to lose. He just keeps putting up the crazy games. But I do think there is a window for Peppers if he... I think Jackson would have to stumble, and Peppers would have to have... He would have to have a big game, do all kinds of things against Ohio State when everybody's watching that game.
Yeah, but that's something that Lamar Jackson doesn't have left.
No, he does not have a showcase game like that. And in particular, it looks like he won't be playing on championship weekend.
That's why I always said with Jabril and Jake Browning and whoever else is in the Heisman race, all the other teams and players in it are firmly in the playoff conversation, and they're going to be playing in games that everyone's going to watch. And so, I mean, I know Lamar Jackson's phenomenal, and certainly if you're, I mean, I know it was just BC, but you put up crazy numbers, like that keeps you fresh. Even if people aren't watching that game, they're going to see highlights, they're going to see the numbers. But, you know, that's why there is an outside shot. Like I said, it's been boring, right? It's been Lamar Jackson since week one. So, you know, maybe it's just more hope for chaos and an interesting race. But But I do think that if Peppers had a big game against Ohio State and Michigan were to play in the Big Ten championship game, I mean,
yeah, I think he'd have to have a big game in the championship game. Those championship games have a huge impact, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody was going to vote for Ndamukong Suh, and then he just obliterated Texas's offensive line in the Big 12 title game when everybody was watching, and he ended up being a finalist. I think
recency bias. It matters.
Oh, there's like, definitely recency bias. Baker Mayfield would have, I think, been in New York last year had he played, you know, the Oklahoma State game on December, whatever it was, December 5th. He didn't play the last weekend. He was out of sight, out of mind. So, you know, Lamar Jackson will do everything he can, but then if he's not playing that last weekend and Jake Browning has a huge game in the Pac-12 title game or Peppers or whoever else people are talking about, Deshaun Watson, obviously, I think there will be an 11th hour push for one of those guys. All right, we'll get back to the podcast in a second, but I have a question for you. Guys, have you ever lost or thought you lost your phone? How awful was that? Even if you found it in 5 minutes, if you're like me, your life is on that phone. Well, guess what? Identity thieves know that too. And when your lost phone winds up in the hands of an identity thief, it can be the beginning of a disaster. Financially, emotionally, even physically, that could take years to unwind. That's why you can help protect yourself with Identity Guard. With Identity Guard, you get protection from a company that's been in this business for over 20 years, one that's helped protect more than 47 million people. Identity Guard continuously monitors millions of transactions and articles and sends you the news, tools, and guidance you need to minimize your risk. Plus, if you're to become a victim of identity theft, Identity Guard's victim recovery specialist will be there to help you through the recovery process. Identity Guard even offers identity theft insurance with coverage of up to $1 million. So get the identity theft protection service that's right for you. Visit Identity Guard at identityguard.com/podcast. That's identityguard.com/podcast. All right, Big Ten Friday night games. You know, the news leaked out last week. They officially announced the lineup on Tuesday. There'll be six games next year. Full disclosure, three of them are on Fox. Big Ten's fans are freaking out. It's you would think that they're being asked to play these games at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. I mean, we play college football on Friday nights. This is not a new thing. It's just new to the Big Ten. We both went to Big Ten schools, you much more recently than me. What are your feelings on it?
I don't care. I mean, I know why people, you know, traditionalists and, you know, anytime something changes in college football, people get uncomfortable. But I think if you look at the teams that are getting that, like, they put out year one, right? I know Northwestern fans are annoyed they're there twice. Okay,
right.
Whatever. But how many people, you get everyone, that game is on every bar, every sports bar, every TV, if it's the only game on. And if it's one of 40 games on a Saturday, it's not on. But for the Indianas, the Rutgers, I mean, Rutgers has played on Friday nights the last few years. You know, I don't understand the uproar.
I think a lot of Big Ten fans feel it's beneath them. Friday night games, that's, you know, Boise State. That's not us. That's not the Big Ten.
But everybody, I mean, the Pac-12 plays Thursdays. I mean, you know,
Pac-12 plays Friday. ACC plays Friday.
I just don't see why people would get up in arms about this. I mean, it's not like they're changing. I mean, leagues have changed the amount of conference games. They have changed which rivalry games are protected, which ones aren't. They have changed divisions. All of those things seem to be way more like I agree. You deserve to have some anger about things like that. I look, what day of the week you play. I mean, it's not like Michigan, Ohio State is moving to Friday. Like, these are the teams that, you know, want that the extra exposure would help. And being the only game on TV would help.
I'm 100% with you. And look, it's not like I haven't, you know, I hate to this day that Big Ten that Delaney added Rutgers and Maryland. I'm a traditionalist in that sense. But this has potential to be a huge positive for the kind of programs that are going to be playing in these games. I totally get why Michigan would not want to host a Friday night game. 100,000 people go to their games. Many of them travel from other parts of the state or wherever, you know, Ohio State, Penn State. And yes, there will be definitely some inconveniences for fans. I heard from Illinois fans who drive down to the games from Chicago. It's going to be hard for them to do that on a Friday. So yes, there is definitely, I don't want to downplay that there will be some people disrupted by this. But at the end of the day, and I'll just use the Northwestern example, They get about 30,000 people to their average game. But if their game is played on a Friday night, you know, they might get 1 million people watching that game because it's the only game on. 1 million, maybe more. It's on at every sports bar. You know who really watches Friday night games? Every college football team in America watches it in their hotels the night before their games. It's great exposure. And the same exact game, Northwestern Maryland is one of them, would be played on Saturday at, you know, 11 a.m. Central on, well, we both work for the Big Ten Network. Let's use a different example. On ESPN News, nobody's going to see it. So it's great exposure for those programs. And, yeah, maybe Northwestern shouldn't be on there twice, but I don't think one.
Theoretically, let's take Northwestern being on there twice out of it. It's one of your games.
Right. Well, and it's only one of their home games. You know, they're not making them host two Friday night games.
But, I mean, for all the uproar, it's maybe going to affect you once a year.
At most, because I would imagine some schools will only do it once every couple years. I do think eventually an Ohio State, a Penn State, a Michigan will be. Maybe they won't be hosting it, but I do think eventually they'll be in one. I think this first year is kind of let's ease everybody into it with Illinois and Purdue and Rutgers and whatnot. But, you know, we fear change. College football fans, we fear change. We will make a big stink about this for a year. And
then people will get used to it.
And that, by the way, that includes, and there's a lot of alarmists, you know, Pat Fitzgerald has said this, many coaches have said this, that it's going to be negatively impact high school games on Friday nights. And I'm sympathetic to that, but I don't believe it. And the reason I say that is the first wave of this started 15 years ago, and I remember the exact same uproar, the exact same, you know, high school associations putting out statements and whatnot. And to this day, I've never heard of a documented case of a state's high school football attendance plummeting because a college in the state was playing a Friday night game. Okay, there's one last thing I want to get to with you. You are also a college basketball writer, and I would argue one of the premier college basketball writers in the country. You know every coach in the country. You can probably rattle off the starting lineups right now, right, of like the top 50 teams. College hoops season starts Friday, believe it or not. And I know there are people listening to this who are college hoops fans, or at least, and I would, by the way, fall in this boat, would like to know who's going to be good this year. You know, give me your three most likely, and then give me one, you know, what, because there always is one, like one wild card team to keep an eye on.
Oh, man, you're like my editor. I actually need to do my Final Four picks. They will run on Friday.
Well, this will be just a little spoiler.
A little bit. It's going to start and end with Duke, and the big news there right now is that the freshmen appear cursed and all appear to be getting injured. Three or four have been injured or had surgery. This is, like 2 years ago, like the insanely talented freshman class that at Duke, surrounded by veterans in Grayson Allen. Yes, he is still at Duke. He is actually only a junior. And then you have Emile Jefferson, fifth-year senior. So they're going to be really good, because those two guys were part of the team 2 years ago that figured out how to blend veterans with the elite freshmen. The issue, again, is health. Harry Giles, he had surgery. He's had some knee issues. He's had three knee surgeries in his young career. So I expect them to really ease him back in and not push him too much. I think they don't want to damage. They want to show he can play and he's healthy. They don't want to re-injure him. They don't want to push him. They're not going to need him to put up crazy numbers or minutes, and you know he'll be off to the NBA, and they want to protect that future. Jason Tatum is going to have a big year. Marquez Bolden will also. So those are the guys to know at Duke. Kentucky, again, has an insane class, per usual. My strategy with Kentucky, honestly, is, you know, they usually bring in a bunch of five or six big-name guys. Just kind of let them start playing and see who emerges as like the go-to guy, or who's the guy who's taking the clutch shots, and who really ignites that offense or defense or whatever it is, because they just kind of start from scratch every single year. So I'm in a little bit wait-and-see mode. I know they basically won a game by 100 points the other day in an exhibition. So clearly things are going well for John Calipari down there. Kansas is another big team to watch. Josh Jackson, they won the Josh Jackson sweepstakes. He, I think, will have a better freshman year than Andrew Wiggins will, because he's got a lot of veteran guys around him. I think this could be, you know, Kansas has lost early in the NCAA tournament the last few years. I mean, they always win the Big 12.
Well, that's the thing, right? They always win the Big 12, and, you know, history keeps repeating itself. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over. Yeah. Every year, everybody picks Kansas to go to the Final Four, and every year they don't, except for one, they don't win the championship, and most years don't even make the Final Four. Actually, he's made two.
I think this will change. They're going to be one of my Final Four picks.
This is the basketball equivalent of, is this the year Notre Dame's going to live up to the hype? Oh, I promise. I swear it's different than every other year.
Well, I guess you could say Notre Dame wins the independent title every single year. So
they're probably not going to this year.
True.
BYU's got that.
This is not going to be, I'll eventually, Sue, I'll eventually give you a dark horse pick, but just as a preliminary overview, another team to watch would be Oregon. They're going to be really good. And Dana Altman's won Coach of the Year in the Pac-12, three of the four last years. But Dylan Brooks, he's got a bit of a foot injury, but he's a stud. He's going to have a big year. They're the Pac-12 favorites by a significant margin. And right now, obviously, I'm at Washington, and part of the reason was to see Markel Fultz, who is right now Draft Express's projected number one pick in the NBA draft, and he's at Washington. Biggest recruit that Lorenzo Romar has got, but he is really fun to watch, and I can say that after watching practice yesterday. He also does all these insane trick shots, which are pretty cool, and you can see them online, but he's so down to earth. He, like, literally played JV basketball as a sophomore, and then skyrocketed up from there and became, you know, a must-have recruit. But Washington was on him early and had seen every game for 2.5 years and felt comfortable there. So I would say the Pac-12 between Oregon and Washington are a lot more must-see TV than they have been. Or, you know, maybe you overlooked Oregon the last few years. But that's kind of my general overview. I think the Big Ten is going to be really interesting and kind of a mishmash. Miles Bridges at Michigan State will be really fun to watch. Indiana should be really good. Nigel Hayes and Bronson Koenig at Wisconsin. But those are going to be kind of the coasts a little bit are where I'm focusing to start the season, at least.
Nigel Hayes and Bronson Koenig have been in college for 27 years, I believe. That's the state of college basketball, right? If a guy's actually you know, play as a freshman or sophomore and then stay 4 years. It's so rare, you know, for a prominent team like that. Those guys were on the team that went to the national title game. Like, Nigel Hayes is like basketball's Taysom Hill, even though he technically...
But literally less years, though.
Yeah,
literally.
No, three less years or two less years. I'm glad to hear what you're saying about... And obviously Oregon was, you know, they were number one seed last year, so it's not like they were a complete unknown. But, you know, since I've moved out to California, which was in 2011... You know, and I grew up a huge college basketball guy in Ohio, in Cincinnati. One of the great benefits of being in New York was that all the good teams, Duke, everybody came through New York at some point, the Big East tournament, you know, in the old league. It's just so dead out here. There's no enthusiasm whatsoever for college hoops. And the games, frankly, those end up being the games I watch a lot because those are the games that are on at, you know, 7:30 or 8 our time. You just realize as you're watching it and you're on Twitter that nobody else in the planet and the rest of the country is watching these games. If they are, they're mostly talking about Bill Walton. So it would be good to have some premiere.
Yeah, I realized that I was at a Gonzaga BYU game, an 8 o'clock Pacific game, and I was like, wow, this game is great. This was back in the Kelly Olynyk team. Mm-hmm. And I just watched Twitter fall asleep. Like, I just watched. Like, I felt like I was out. You know, like, if you send a tweet out and don't get any responses, like, did it even happen?
Yes. I mean, I was at an Arizona-Stanford game when Arizona was number one in the country, and they almost lost, and there was no great fervor on Twitter. You know, one thing that has actually hurt Pac-12 hoops in all seriousness is, believe it or not, the Golden State Warriors. Because most people, if they're going to stay up at 10:30 Eastern and watch a basketball game, it's going to be that. The Warriors are must-see TV. And here, too, you know. If there was a Cal or Stanford basketball game on the same night as a Warriors game, forget it. The ratings and the household shares for these Warriors games here, you know, they get absurd amount percentage of TVs are watching those games. So I would be remiss if I didn't let you plug. You've been so generous with your time here on the Audible and gamely trying to fill the shoes of one Bruce Feldman.
Big shoes.
Big shoes. You definitely succeeded in terms of providing us with great nuggets and knowledge. You did not curse, though, and Bruce is good for at least 2 or 3 F-bombs a podcast.
I'm sorry. I'm a respectable, kind person who only curses in private.
In fact, if I had gotten him on here the morning after the election, we might have set all new records for it.
I probably helped you guys keep your jobs. Let's
pretty much, yeah. He is he is in Utah blissfully in Arizona. It's Utah at Arizona State, blissfully unaware of any of this. So your podcast, plug it.
Yeah, well, I'm part of USA Today. We have the Football 4 podcast for college football. This season we've been doing every day, so I will actually, I know, Sue, we want to talk about that. I'll let you know how our, ultimately at the end of the season, how that worked, because you guys go a couple times a week, and we're doing 5. So, yeah, sometimes we do that. We also have some issue podcasts. Basically, just follow me on Twitter, at Nicole Auerbach, and I will have lots of strong opinions to share with you, either in podcast form or in tweet form.
And you also get pictures of her dog.
Oh, yes, and especially on Instagram.
You get lots. And your dog's name is?
Red Auerbach. I mean, how could he not be?
All right. As always, if you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Bruce will be back next week, so send us your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.